on BCFM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Why did the US embrace Nazi war criminals at the end of World War II? Was it to fight the Russians in the Cold War or to do a deal for uranium and plutonium? Yes, that's a report delayed from 2 weeks ago. And also the voice of a true US Army hero this week, the leaked audio recording of Bradley Manning giving his secret testimony to a secret call. Plus, EDF Energy, who are planning to build a new nuclear power station at Hinkley, dropped their £5 million legal action against protesters. Cheeky so-and-sos. We hear from Friends of the Earth's Mike Birkin, plus Martin Summers takes his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. But first, the Police Federation have been balloting their members. They got an 81% vote nationally in favour of strike action. Now, Kevin Phillips, who's the chairman of Avon and Somerset Police Federation, is joining me now. Kevin, that doesn't really seem to make sense. 81% nationally in favour of potentially, anyway, changing the constitution of your organisation to allow for the right to strike, and yet nothing's going to change.
Yeah, it's also a very difficult position to be in. Basically, we set a very high standard for what we required as a turnout to actually do the ballot, and that was going to be 50% plus one. And clearly, nationally, when the figures came back, there was only 42% of all the eligible officers to vote that actually voted.
So does that indicate, do you think, a bit of apathy amongst the police, not actually bothering to turn out to vote?
I think it's something that we don't really know why that happened. I mean, one of the big problems that we've got coming up with regards to the Windsor reviews and everything else like that is a question of compulsory severance. Now, my opinion, that is redundancy in any other name, is the severance. Now, if we're going to go down that, and then we had that question and the ballot done after those decisions, then I think we'd have a totally different result.
So do you think you'll be rerunning the ballot in the future? Is that feasible?
I'm certainly not going to rule it out. There is a meeting next week nationally at federation level to discuss the results of the ballot. I wouldn't rule out the once the compulsory severance has been decided, which is due in July this year, that we may well look towards running the ballot again.
Okay, so 81% in favour of stopping this ban on striking, effectively, you know, opening the way to the police striking, is a national figure. What was the local figure in Avon and Somerset?
Well, the local figure, of all the officers that could vote within Avon and Somerset, 44% voted. Out of the 44% that voted, 69% voted in favour of industrial
okay,
action.
Okay, so that's roughly 70 compared to 80. Yeah. I mean, that's lower than the national average. Does that suggest that the police officers around here are a bit more content than they are in other parts of the country?
I would probably suggest police officers around the country are not content anywhere, the way this government's dealing with them. I just think it's probably the way the figures worked out, and I don't think there would be any rhyme or reason as to why that would happen.
Okay, so you can't explain it either. Overall then, if the vote had been, you know, a larger turnout, and there had been an idea, I mean, surely you can't have police striking. It's simply not possible. I mean, this is like holding, really, literally, a hammer over the head of the government and of the Home Secretary, and saying, well, look guys, for the next few weeks or for the next few days, if there is the police are on strike, you're going to have the riot conditions like we saw 2 years ago across the country.
I think it's always a very difficult position to be in. I mean, this would be the last resort of any police service. The way that it has been looked at, as I said earlier and touched on it, you know, we've had a number of reviews going on, we've had a number of things going on by this government with regards to the police service, and people are absolutely fed up. Now, what you've got to look at the moment, we are Crown servants. We don't have any industrial rights whatsoever. Now,
Sounds like you're at the court of the Queen or something, and you've got to sort of bow down. That's what a crown servant sounds like to me.
That's effectively what we are. You know, the Queen employs us effectively.
It's a medieval type of a system.
But we are in that difficult position. Now, touching back onto the compulsory severance, and as I say, we would regard that as redundancy in any other name. If we're going to be going down that route, then surely we should be afforded the same rights as any other employee. That's exactly what it comes down to.
The other thing is, of course, with compulsory redundancies, as we saw at the BBC recently, threats of compulsory redundancies, people can be specifically singled out and targeted to be made redundant with no kind of question about whether they're competent or less competent or more competent. This does enable the managers to actually target people for their politics as well. So you're a little bit nervous about that potentially happening within the police force.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, invariably, we are going to be worried about anything that goes on down that route. We are aware that there's a number of things that have to be done beforehand. They have to look at voluntary severance first. And I know for a fact that Avon and Somerset wouldn't even entertain that at this moment in time because it's too expensive.
I mean, do you not see that, you know, maybe the public are actually more up for something like this, you know, not necessarily taking the side of the police, when we've got the situation with the recent revelations about the Hillsborough inquiry and police covering up and falsifying evidence there to protect themselves. And we've also got the whole Jimmy Savile business, a report out this week, which we'll talk about in a minute, is saying that the police just were reluctant to investigate Jimmy Savile because he was a celebrity, which just sounds appalling. And then there's also the phone hacking and all this stuff to do with the Leveson inquiry, which is going to be big in the news, of course, again next week when there's it looks like a Commons vote on it, where actually the police could have gone with the evidence they had on phone hacking and arrested these people like Rebecca Brooks, potentially, who's one of the alleged criminals involved, and Andy Coulson long, long ago, probably 5 years ago, but they just simply didn't do it. I mean, one would look at it and think, well, again, it's their celebrity status or some kind of, you know, hidden connection with the police that they feel that they're being protected from the law being enforced. So, I mean, there's not a lot of sympathy at the moment, Kevin, for the police in these specific three areas, the Savile, the Hillsborough and the phone hacking.
I think the way I would look at that is that clearly, you know, we're only policed by consent, and we do need the consent of the public to actually carry out our job. The Hillsborough and the Savile inquiries, I would put down as, and I'm not belittling them at all because I think they were outrageous in what's gone on, but we're in that position where they were historical investigations. I appreciate the Leveson and everything that goes with that, but invariably somewhere along the line there's always going to be cases like this that come out of the woodwork.
But, I mean, ultimately, do you think, I mean, because we one of the senior police from, I think it was from HMIC, was on the record as saying that it's potential that another Jimmy Savile type situation can happen. The problem being, of course, that there's not really, there's a lot of trust of the police force. When someone goes to the police with evidence, say, for example, of sexual abuse, you know, in Savile's case, there's a tremendous amount of trust that the police are going to take that evidence seriously and carry it through. And there also seem to be quite a lot of stumbling blocks, whether it's from the police itself or from the Crown Prosecution Service, to that evidence ever coming to court.
Yeah, I mean, the quote that you're talking about came from Sir Peter Fahey, GMP. I agree with everything that you are saying. There is stumbling blocks there, and I feel for anybody that approaches the police with regards to any sexual abuse or sexual assault. It's a very difficult position to be in, and I can never say that I've ever been in that position to understand how much courage, if that's the word I would use, it would take for somebody to actually approach the police. Now, if it's not dealt with properly and compassionately, I have to agree with you. It's got to be very difficult for these people.
I mean, we've heard this week in 1963, and I'm not asking you to excuse this behaviour, but we heard in 1963 a Cheshire man was told by a police officer to forget all about it and to move on when he reported an allegation of rape by Savile, according to the Inspectorate of Constabulary. Another man who tried to report an assault his girlfriend had suffered at a recording of Top of the Pops was told by the police he could be arrested for making such allegations.
I think I've got to go back and say these are historical cases. I would like to think, since those times, we've moved on dramatically within the police service as to the way we operate, what we do and how we do things.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. The police are having a bit of a difficult time of it at the moment because it looks as if they're, you know, they're the government are moving ahead with the idea of compulsory redundancies of the police at a time when their image and their, I mean, through these cases I've been talking about, and of course police morale is at rock bottom.
Yes, and I sympathise greatly with the situation that they find themselves in. I think what you were saying last time you were on the show, Kevin, was that in actual fact the government may take steps to make it impossible for you to strike, even if you got a successful ballot through.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, it would take many, many years to actually get to the point, and at the end of the day, the Home Secretary can still turn around and say, I'm not adopting it.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, I think it's the solution's got to be political, hasn't it? I mean, you know, rather than you going on strike, we need to, you know, the government needs to listen to what you're saying to them and take note. And if they won't take note, then they'll have to change the government and get one that does take note. I mean, that's the way it's done, isn't it?
I think, you know, the Police Federation have always been very successful because of their powers of persuasion. And I think that's part of what we've done, the negotiation and everything we've ever done. Clearly, this government doesn't want to listen to the police service.
Is that
the police
persuasion budget. With or without handcuffs on?
Well, they don't want to listen to the people of the front line of the health service, or the police service, or the schools. I mean, they just don't listen to people who are doing those jobs. I mean, that's just patent, isn't it?
And Kevin, would you say that there is a tension? I mean, I know this was exposed by Duncan Campbell and others in the 1980s. A tension between the Home Office and ACPO, as both. Seeing themselves as bodies who are partly involved in putting forward police policy and in fact in some cases operational policy. Do you think that tension is still there between the Home Office and the Association of Chief Police Officers?
Well, as you're probably aware, that ACPO have actually disappearing now, that they're actually going out of business, for want of a better word, and that is purely because the funding's not there and everything else that goes with it. Clearly.
So I suppose that's maybe Theresa May thinking to herself, look, if I want to have a battle with Association of Chief Police Officers, the easiest thing to do is to turn off the tap.
And that's exactly, you know, that's what we've been looking at, you know, with regards to the independent review of the Police Federation. I've been at a meeting today. The discussion was, well, if we don't do it to ourselves, would Theresa May do it to us? And that's always the debate you've got to have.
OK, tell us a bit about this Windsor review, because I know that the concept of compulsory redundancies for the first time for police is one of the things that came out of that. What else does this Windsor review mean for you?
There's many things that have come out of the Windsor review. I mean, clearly, it's a big change in our terms and conditions, and I would probably say that Tom Windsor, however he worked it and the advice he got, it clearly wasn't for the benefit of the rank-and-file police officers out there on the front line. You know, there's lots of things that have come out of it. Police officers are losing money, and I'm not talking of small amounts of money, they're losing substantial amounts of money from their salaries because of the things that they've lost, the overtime and everything that goes with it, the allowances and stuff like that. And whilst I appreciate we're all in that same position at the moment, and we're all, you know, at least we've got a job, and I do understand that, but at the end of the day, if you sign up for a job, effectively a contract, you would expect the government to honour that, and that is clearly not happening.
Now, one question I have to put to you, I don't have to do anything, but I really feel I ought to, is this whole business of fraud. I mean, this is a white-collar crime which goes on all the time, it seems, at the moment. Ever since the County NatWest trial, the Blue Arrow trial in the early 1990s, it seems there's a green light gone up in the city saying you can commit fraud and no police officer is going to come and feel your collar. Is it possible, do you think, for the police in the future to start getting a little bit more aggressive, feeling the collars of some of these bankers? We've been discussing earlier on today about the LIBOR fraud and the billions of pounds which has been effectively fraudulently stolen from people's accounts, people's mortgages as a result of that, and yet for some reason it seems that the whatever the authorities are, I think it's the FSA, Financial Services Authority in that case, possibly the Serious Fraud Office, I'm not sure, but they settle out of court, for goodness sake. They don't even go to court and prosecute people. Surely the only clear message to send out to fraudsters is, you know, you're going to end up in jail.
Oh, I think I would agree with you on that. You know, there's been many calls with regards to the big banking frauds that have been going on at the moment for people to face the criminal proceedings, and I think that is quite right. That's exactly what should happen.
Martin, in Iran, we've heard recently that there are some quite serious Four bankers have been sentenced to death for fraud. This is from Op-Ed News. Last month, Iran did something that Obama, Op-Ed News is saying, and his neutered puppy, Attorney General Eric Holder, should be doing. They sentenced four bankers to death based on fraud charges. Other bankers involved in the fraud were sentenced to life imprisonment, flogging, cash fine. Well, I don't know about flogging. That sounds a bit dreadful. But and also capital punishment is a pretty harsh. Cash fines were banned. And they were banned from holding public office too. The Iran judiciary has handed down death sentences of four people convicted of involvement in the biggest embezzlement case in the country's banking history.
Well, I don't really approve of executing and flogging people, even if they are fraudsters. And you know, are they guilty? It's possibly they are.
Do you think that any of the fraudsters in the City of London will be scratching their heads and looking at this?
The U.S. economist Peter Galbraith, who is the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, who is one of Kennedy's advisors, he's pushing very hard for criminal prosecutions of bankers, because ultimately, if you don't do that, the faith in the system will collapse, and that will collapse the system. But the problem is, the banks are so fragile that if you were to start going through the books properly and prosecuting people as you should, and you know, thousands of executives were sent to prison in the 1980s during the savings and loans scandal, then the banks would collapse. And of course, we don't want the banks to collapse, because then the economy will collapse. So they've got us basically backed into a corner. So but ultimately, they will collapse, and when they have collapsed, Then we'll have to pick up the pieces.
But I mean, surely it's better to deal with that now, while we kick the can down the road and wait for them to collapse in the future.
It's too late. We've had 4 years since the 2008 crash, and I'm afraid there's probably going to be another crash. I think it's probably going to happen probably over the summer. And this time, of course, there will be no bailout money, because that's all gone. And then, of course, we'll start to ask some real questions. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the ruling class, in this country and the United States of America, are criminals. Andreotti, who was the Prime Minister of Italy, was put on trial three times, not for cooperating with the Mafia, for being a Mafia chief. And the police put him on trial three times, and he got off three times, because these people have good lawyers. And George Bush has been in prison. Tony Blair should be in prison. A lot of these people should be in prison.
I mean, the problem here, Kevin, and maybe this is one of the reasons why morale in the police is so low, as you keep telling us almost every time you're in here, is that it's much easier for the police to prosecute someone who's poor, maybe who's committing a petty crime, maybe shoplifting or stealing, because they simply don't have any money, they've been cut off from their benefits or something. That those kinds of people are much easier for the police to go for than the big fraudsters, who maybe have got the best lawyers in the country. I mean, you know, they can maybe afford to pay somebody who will give them nice bail conditions, and then ultimately the police won't go anywhere. So do you think that has anything to do with the low morale at the moment in the force?
I wouldn't necessarily say it's got anything to do with the low morale. You're quite right. Anybody that's got the money can afford the best lawyers to actually bail them out of these situations. It's quite interesting. Only this week I've actually been at an awards ceremony at police headquarters, and within that awards ceremony, there was three or four Crown Court commendations for officers that have actually investigated major frauds, some which have taken over 5 years to deal with. So they're actually, you know, we do it and we can get there, but when you get to the big bankers, then it needs a lot of hard work.
Yes, it certainly does. Martin, any prospects, do you think, for criminal charges being pressed against some of these people? I mean, we had Mohammed Rafiq the other day saying that it's not only the traders themselves that have committed fraud, and it's the evidence is there that they have. It's also the directors of these banks who have literally, even if they didn't know about it, then they've been negligent, and they should be prosecuted too.
Well, the UN report on drugs and crime from 2008 pointed out that the drug cartels basically bailed the banking system out at that point. HSBC was the tip of the iceberg. In actual fact, I think virtually the whole banking system is a criminal scam, partly because of illegal drugs. Illegal drugs creates a huge market. It's probably one of the biggest industries on the planet, and it corrupts everything. And ultimately, the fact that the ruling class are criminal, and that's not political rhetoric, they are criminal, that is going to be their Achilles heel. And I would see, as we saw in Italy in the 90s, I would see the police service as allies in trying to clean out these stables. And what we need is senior, you know, proper police officer get stuck into these people with the support of the public, and we will change.
I mean, with HSBC, for example, now I'm trying to remember the figures, I think it was 12 billion money laundered. They got a fine, Kevin, of 2 billion.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's typical, and that's, you know, the way the outrageous sentencing goes, or, you know, the fines that go with it. You've got to hit
fines people. Fines aren't good enough.
No.
Yeah, no, they need to go to prison.
No, I would agree with you.
If you get fined less than you've actually stolen, that's just a... Yeah.
And actually, it's the business that's getting fined, not the individuals.
No, I would agree with you entirely on that, and I think the individuals should face the consequences.
OK, finally then, Kevin, what do you think it is that's responsible for the low morale within the police at the moment? And I mean, particularly, this low turnout also suggests that, doesn't it?
Yes, and that would be my take on it, the fact that people have been beaten and kicked and everything else like that, the police officers themselves, and they've just got fed up with it. There is a low morale within the police service. The University of West of England have just done a study on the morale of police officers, and it's quite telling if ever you get a chance to read it.
Okay. Also, I said finally, but what about the new chief constable? We've got a new chap at the beginning of this month, Nick Gargan. What's the Federation's thoughts about him, or your thoughts anyway?
Well, I think Nick, I mean, he's been in post 2 weeks now. You know, he's currently finding his way around the force at the moment. He clearly came to the organisation saying he hadn't brought a policy in a suitcase. He wanted to find his way around, and I'm aware that that's what he's been doing. He's been going around to all the various districts, meeting various people, discussing what's going on. We've been heavily involved in everything that's been going on with Nick Gargan as well. So hopefully we're looking towards having a fruitful relationship with him.
Well, we'll see if we can get him on here as well. The last Chief Constable, Colin Port, was the abject refused time after time. A bit like our City Slacker MPs, Dawn Primarolo, Chris Skidmore, and who's the other one? Charlotte Leslie, who haven't come on. Anyway, Kevin Phillips, Chairman of Avon and Somerset Police Federation, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you very much.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Martin, let's just go back to for a moment to that story about the banker's sentence for death for fraud in Iran. This does send out a pretty strong signal, doesn't it, that Iran is dealing with fraud in a very, very different way to the Western world.
Yes, and I mean, I don't really know much about the Iranian legal system, but I suspect it leaves much to be desired in terms of, you know, whether people get properly represented and so on. I mean, people deserve to be properly represented. They need to have their day in court properly.
Okay. Also, today we've had the announcement of a new defence minister for the Israelis. I'm not sure his first name, Mr. Yalon. Now, he is a pretty controversial figure. Many describe him as a war criminal. In fact, he was refused entry to Britain, but he cancelled a visit to Britain a couple of years ago because he was afraid that as soon as he stepped off the plane at Heathrow, he was going to be clapped in irons, arrested for war crimes.
Well, yes, I mean, this is an open sore and has been for many years, isn't it? I mean, we've got a situation where the Middle East as a whole is on a knife edge now, and we could have, you know, a major war breaking out right across the Middle East. You know, the Israelis could be into Lebanon or Syria, you know, as we speak almost. And, you know, it's a pretty dangerous situation.
But what about the idea of, you know, war criminals potentially anyway becoming, you know, the people who are running their entire defence of a country like Israel, for example, here?
Well, that's if you're a war criminal, you've got to expect some comeback, haven't you? Whether you're Israeli or anybody else.
Well, the Israeli president, Shimon Peres, was at the European Union this week talking, amongst other things, about Syria. So let's have a listen to an extract from what he had to say.
The greatest danger to peace in the world today is the present Iranian regime. A clear voice must be raised against the violation of human rights by the Iranian regime. A clear voice must be raised against a regime that hangs people without bringing them to court, that throws journalists into prison without trial, that fires bullets, live bullets, at civilian demonstrators without respect for their life. A clear voice must be raised against a regime that discriminates against women. Hezbollah is a terror organization, not a political movement. We appeal to you. Call terror, terror. Save Lebanon from terrorist madness. Save the Syrian people from the Iran proxies. Save your citizens and ours from Hezbollah. The international community has to designate Hezbollah as a terrorist organization because they are a terrorist organization.
That was the Israeli President Shimon Peres there at the European Union this week.
Yes, I mean, all this stuff about Hezbollah being a terrorist organisation. They are, in fact, in the democratically elected government of Lebanon. And people may not like it, but they are. And, in fact, they are, they, you know, the Lebanese army is under Hezbollah control. And ultimately, of course, we could have... You see, in Lebanon and Iraq, the two democratically elected governments there are supporting Assad for various reasons. And the Israelis, of course, are pouring more petrol on the flames. And we could have a major Middle East war, you know, virtually at any moment.
Well, what does he mean exactly by the Iran proxies in Syria he's talking about there?
Well, I mean, they keep on going about the Iranian regime not respecting human rights, and I'm perfectly prepared to accept that. But then the Saudi regime doesn't respect human rights, but do we care about that? No. You know, in Syria, they don't respect human rights, but they don't, you know, the pro-Western regimes don't respect human rights either. And the West policy of supporting armed rebellion in Syria, they better be thinking very carefully about that, because, of course, they're justifying, ultimately, armed rebellion in Saudi Arabia. I mean, let's have the king of Saudi Arabia shot through the head and sodomised with a bayonet on YouTube like Gaddafi. Let's put them all up against a wall. That's British policy. That's where it's leading.
While we're talking about Israelis and Syria there particularly, we've also had the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, in London this week, having talks with William Hague, our Foreign Secretary. So let's have a listen to what they both had to say. First of all, Sergei Lavrov from Russia, and then William Hague.
The international law does not allow supplies of arms to non-governmental actors, and in our point of view, it is a violation of the international law. And there is a humanitarian crisis. But we should not just stick to the only decision of arming the opposition. We should think about what is going to happen next and try to have a broader understanding.
Foreign Secretary, you were quite specific that Britain would, as you put it, increase support to the Syrian rebels. I'd just like to spell out precisely for people what Britain means by increasing support.
The support we give is exactly what I've announced in Parliament, and that is our position. Again, as the Defence Secretary has said, we've never ruled out anything in the future. We don't know how grave this situation will become. It is already a situation of extreme humanitarian need. There is a possibility that it will get even worse, if we can imagine something even worse than millions of people on the move, tens of thousands losing their lives. You can hear from everything we have said today the emphasis on a political settlement and a political process, and the UK and Russia both have an important role to play in that, and that is why we've spent a lot of time on it.
Now, that was Alex Thompson from Channel 4 News asking William Hague that question about what exactly the increase in support for the rebels in Syria by the British Foreign Secretary actually means. I know he's talking about things like armoured cars, Martin. They're not quite up to necessarily giving them rocket launchers, but they're getting these kind of weapons via the Saudis anyway.
Yeah, they are. And the problem is, you see, that the borders in the Middle East were drawn by the Sykes-Picot Agreement at the end of the First World War, and they're not really rational borders. So the Sunni terrorists in Iraq, who are trying to bomb the Shia government out of power by attacking Shia mosques and so on, and of course, you know, the West kind of supports the Iraqi government because we put them in power, but exactly the same people, the same Sunni tribes, are trying to overthrow Assad, and they're being supported by the West in Syria, and they're being tortured by the American, you know, the Guardian this week brought out this whole thing about they were running torture centres for the Shia militia and police in Iraq. So the Sunni terrorists who have got to be defeated in Iraq are exactly the same people as we're supporting in Syria.
Well, and these weapons will be swapped
around. The border's fungible anyway.
Well, we had an amazing situation last week with the visit of, a week before last actually, wasn't it, with the visit of John Kerry, the new US foreign state, from the State Department, Secretary of State, and he and William Hague have both been talking about increasing support for the rebels in Syria. And then we had the crazy situation last week where those same rebels then kidnapped a load of people in the Golan Heights from the United Nations. Now, I'm also reading online, I don't know what you've been reading, Martin, that actually what's happening is that the Syrian army under Assad is controlling and stabilising more parts at the moment of Syria. So it's only something like 10% of it is being destabilised. Hence, that might be one of the reasons why these rebels have been pushed up to the Golan Heights on the Israeli border. And they're looking actually to have a fight with somebody. And the only people they can find around to have a fight with are the UN peacekeepers.
Well, I mean, they just got caught up in the situation. The situation is absolutely dire.
But why are we arming a group of people who are then going and kidnapping UN peacekeepers?
Because Western intelligence services have been working with Al-Qaeda-linked groups like the Islamic Fighting Group for donkey's years. And the Al-Nusra Front inside Syria is an Al-Qaeda group, and it's being supported by Western intelligence services. You think, oh, this can't be. We've got a war on terror. We're supposed to be against these people, aren't we? No, that's not how it works. In actual fact, the West uses Islamic terrorism in order to destabilise the regimes it doesn't like. And the Russians, frankly, are getting fed up with it. And of course, if we do have a major Middle East war, it could bring in Russia and China on the side of Iran. It's going to be interesting, isn't it?
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Peculiar story. I actually found this on Bristol Indie Media, but it was one of their hidden stories. Bizarrely, Bristol Indie Media have hidden a story which is actually all about a connection between 9/11 hijackers and a Bristol-based oil executive. Abdulaziz Al-Hiji and his wife Anoud left three cars at their luxurious home in a gated community in Florida. One of them knew and flew to Saudi Arabia in August 2001. The refrigerator was full of food, furniture and clothing were left behind, and the swimming pool water was still circulating. Security records of cars passing through a checkpoint at the Presidencia gated community indicated that Mr. Al-Hiji's home, Escondido Circle, had been visited a number of times by Mohammed Atta, the leader of the 19-strong hijack team for 9/11, who piloted American Airlines Flight 11 into the North Tower of the World Trade Center. The logs also indicated that Marwan al-Shehhi, who crashed United Airlines Flight 175 into the South Tower, and Ziad Jarrah, who was at the controls of the United Airlines Flight 93 when it crashed into a field in Pennsylvania, had visited the house. Now, a decade after the world's worst terrorist attack, which claimed the lives of 3,000 people, Mr. Al-Hiji is resident in Bristol, working for a European subsidiary of Saudi Aramco, Saudi Arabia's state oil company. Described as a career counsellor, he's based in the offices at Aramco Overseas Company UK Limited and lives in an expensive flat in central Bristol. So, amazing. This guy is actually living in central Bristol, Martin, and it looks like all the major hijackers visited his pad in Florida literally a month before the hijacking.
Listen, it's interesting. Mohammed Atta also visited the yacht of the Republican lobbyist Abrams. I can't remember his actual name. So, yes, well, 9/11, we often cover this topic.
But I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that he is linked to Saudi Arabia just as Bin Laden through an oil company.
But I mean, as I said earlier, the Western intelligence services have always had links with Islamic terrorist groups. It goes back for years and years and years. Let me just point out to people, the thing that people that Radio 4 will not be telling you is that the head of the Russian General Staff, General Leonid Ivashov, he's retired now. He was in charge of the Russian General Staff on 9/11/2001. He's absolutely clear it was an inside job. Now, he may be wrong, but I would suggest that the head of the Russian General Staff probably has access to information lacking from some of the media commentators in the West. Basically, around the world, if you go to Venezuela, for example, and you say, I was in Colombia a few years ago, going meeting trade unions and social activists in Colombia, and said, well, we suspect that the Americans may have actually done 9/11 themselves. And they went, claro, it's obvious. Out there in the real world, everybody knows.
It has to be said, though, in email correspondence with the Daily Telegraph, who this story appeared, written by Anthony Summers, Neil Tweedy and Dan Christensen, Mr. Al-Hiji strongly denied any involvement in the 9/11 plot, writing, I have neither relation nor association with any of those bad people stroke criminals and the awful crime they did. 9/11 is a crime against the USA and all humankind. I'm very saddened and depressed by these false allegations. Well, it may be that it's strange, though, isn't it, that, you know, they went in and out of his pad in
Florida. Yes, well, what's also very strange, it was reported by the BBC and the Daily Telegraph, that various of these so-called hijackers turned up alive and said, hang on a minute, I'm alive. And, you know, the whole story, as soon as you start to look at it, falls apart. Basic things. Where was the Air Force for an hour and a half? Don't forget, you've got the most expensive Air Force in history, defending the most heavily defended airspace in history. The Pentagon, probably the most heavily defended spot on the planet. And for an hour and a half, planes fly around inside US airspace. And they didn't fly directly to the targets either. They flew in a very, very bizarre kind of dog legs all the way to the target. How do you do that? How do you fly it? You can't fly on instruments. 30,000 feet.
Yes, you can.
No. Well, you can't fly on sight, is what I'm saying. Yeah,
right. Visual flying.
You can't fly on visual sight. Anyway, the basic fact is, the Russian general staff and the Iranian general staff, Ahmadinejad, pointed out at the UN that he wasn't happy with the story. Chavez was never happy with the story.
And Alan Sabrosky, of course, Sabrosky, from the U.S. Army War College.
U.S. Army War College. That's right. I mean, Major General Stubblebine in the U.S. There's a brilliant website called Military Officers for 9/11 Truth, in which hundreds of U.S. military officers point out that the story put forward by the government simply doesn't add up. And of course, that's why we're going to have World War III. That's why. Because basically, the people running the United States of America are criminal fascists.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Well, the Queen's Sri Lanka visit for a Commonwealth meeting is grotesque. And this is Jonathan Miller at Channel 4 News. David Miliband and Sir Malcolm Rifkin call on the Commonwealth Secretariat to stop Sri Lanka from hosting its heads of government meeting because of the country's poor human rights record. Well, this isn't the only royal human rights disaster story this week. We've had Charles and Camilla out in Jordan and in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, of course, being a place where, literally on the day that Prince Charles arrived, there were seven people publicly beheaded in Saudi Arabia. There was no mention and no discussion, apparently, between him and the Saudi leaders about whether this was a good thing to do.
Yes, and Saudi Arabia crossed an international border to invade the Bahrain, which is absolutely against international law. That's like the invasion of Czechoslovakia. But are we supporting armed struggle inside Syria, inside Saudi Arabia, to get rid of these wretched people and their allies, the British Tory Party, the US Republican Party? I say, if we're going to have bloody revolution in Syria, let's have bloody revolution. Let's go and put the whole Saudi Qatari ruling class up against a wall and blow their brains out like we did in Libya.
But Martin, you can't do that.
Oh no, I'm just pointing out the logic of the British government's so-called position on the Middle East. Absolutely ridiculous.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Finally, land reform has enabled tens of thousands of farmers to own their land. In total, Venezuela distributed more than 3 million hectares. I'm talking, of course, about the sad death of Hugo Chavez, the general who was involved in a coup, who then took over as the president of Venezuela. Oh, it was a colonel, was he? Okay. Colonels normally do coups, don't they? So anyway, what are your thoughts about the passing of Hugo Chavez? And, of course, the other question is, he himself wondered whether he'd been poisoned, as so many other people have, and that somehow, you know, that there was some kind of foul play involved, and that he was actually assassinated by slow death of cancer.
Well, he certainly had some very, very strange symptoms. And, of course, it's perfectly legitimate for people to ask whether he was assassinated. I don't know. Maybe he was. I mean, certainly, you know, if people are prepared to blow up skyscrapers and kill their own people to start wars, assassinating foreign leaders is pretty small beer, isn't it? Well, people in Venezuela are pretty much convinced he was assassinated. That's clear.
Jimmy Carter, former US president, has said that Venezuela's electoral system was actually the best in the world.
Yes, and I looked at the stats for his time in power, for the economy. Brilliant. He's actually really managed the economy well, far better than George Osborne's managing here.
So, you know, if he were to George was to take a leaf out of Hugo's book, although I suppose he wouldn't wish to, what should he be doing that Hugo's done?
Well, I mean, he's a world historical figure. He's changed the thinking for socialists all over the world. And of course, what was really important in Venezuela was that the army has been used to repress the people in Latin America terribly over the decades, and the Venezuelan army has been turned into an instrument to stand. He said, I believe, Chavez said, like Salvador Allende, I believe in peace and democracy, but unlike Salvador Allende, I am armed.
Okay. Another thing he did, an achievement that maybe people realise, is he actually halved the infant mortality rate from 1999 to 2012 within just over 10 years.
Yeah. And if you look at the actual stats for the mainstream economy, the private sector grew bigger than the public sector. They've had really good growth figures. They've lifted half the population out of poverty. It just goes to show, when people say, oh, politics, it doesn't matter, they're all the same. No. Not true.
In the same period since 1999, nearly half child malnutrition was reduced by nearly half.
Yes, and the US tried to overthrow the democratically elected government of Venezuela in 2002. And people go, oh, well, why do people hate us? What do we do? Because you try and overthrow their democratic governments. Maybe they should invade you and make sure you've got a democratic government. Storm up from Venezuela up through the Mexican border.
Also, Hugo Chavez has Venezuela built nearly 700,000 homes over those 10 years.
That's another thing that George Osborne ought to take some notice of, eh?
Malnutrition fell from 21% in 98 to only 3% in 2012.
Yes, and you'll see even the liberal press snidey attacks on Chavez. He's a dictator, he's this, he's a that. It's just sour grapes. He was a very successful politician and political leader. And I think Nicolas Maduro, who's going to take over from him, he looks pretty good as well, actually.
What makes you say that?
Well, I mean, I don't know much about Maduro, but I mean, I do know that, for example, William Rodriguez, who was the janitor in the World Trade Center, went to visit Nicolas Maduro when he was the foreign secretary of Venezuela. And Maduro, you know, I mean, the problem for Chavez was he was such a kind of star that he had to build a movement that could carry on without him. But I think they're there. I mean, Maduro will probably win the presidential election. It's quite clear that the Venezuelan Socialist Party is pretty strong.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
And we had the fascinating audio leak this week from the trial of the US Army soldier, Private Bradley Manning, who leaked a fantastic amount of information over to WikiLeaks, including the famous footage from an American helicopter with the pilot and the gunners just simply laughing as people were killed and shot. Including Reuters team and Reuters cameramen and that kind of thing. He says, essentially, and here's a clip from that audio, that he's done it really to try and provoke debate.
I began to become depressed at the situation that we found ourselves increasingly mired in. In attempting to conduct counterterrorism, CT, and counterinsurgency coin operations, we became obsessed with capturing and killing human targets on lists and on being suspicious of and avoiding cooperation with our host nation partners. I believe that if the general public, especially the American public, had access to the information contained within the CIDI and IAEA tables, this could spark a domestic debate on the role of the military and our foreign policy in general, as well as related to Iraq and Afghanistan.
That was Bradley Manning. I'll just keep it short because it's actually quite difficult to hear. But he's talking about really completely not trusting the US Army, not trusting host nations. I'm wanting to get a debate going about whether there really was any point in being in Iraq and Afghanistan, and if so, how they should do operations in those countries.
Well,
and
yes.
That, of course, is the first time we've heard the voice of Bradley Manning.
Mm. Yes, well, I mean, full marks to him for making a stand. What else can you say? The people in charge really are criminal lunatics, and something's going to have to be done pretty soon about all of this.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Well, winding back a little bit and coming into the Bristol zone, I'm joined by Mike Birkin, who's been sitting patiently here while we roam around the Middle East and other parts of the world, by Mike Birkin from Friends of the Earth Southwest. Mike, first I want to ask you about this week is this decision to drop, the EDF have done, to drop the court case against the protesters. What on earth did they think they were doing? Very, very cheeky, massive, powerful company with loads of money deciding to try and stop protests literally by closing it down by prosecuting people for protesting. What was the nitty-gritty of the case?
Yeah, that was very much the size of it. I mean, the protesters from the organisation No Dash for Gas occupied the construction site of a new gas power station which EDF were building. They stayed, it was quite an amazing stunt because they stayed up there for a week and very brave, and people who take non-violent direct action in defence of wider social justice causes do so clearly in the knowledge that they're going to face the consequences in law, and indeed they did. They were charged with aggravated trespass and have been sentenced for their part in that protest. But then in addition to that, EDF, the owners of the power station, weighed in with a really threatening, punitive civil claim, saying they were going to claim millions of pounds of damages from each of these protesters for the loss of their earnings during the period that that power station was unable to continue its construction because they were up the tower. Now, EDF then provoked a backlash, and thousands of people have taken to social media to protest against what EDF were planning to do. Our organisation, Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace, many others, claimed that this was a rank injustice, and as you say, EDF were merely trying to close down protest. Hundreds of people then started taking again to social media to say that they were switching their accounts away from EDF to another supplier, and that's when it started to hurt them. EDF realised that they were heading for a commercial and public relations disaster, and they reached an accommodation with the protesters and backed down. So it's a victory to it's a victory to No Dash for Gas.
Well, I'll just interrupt you slightly, Mark, because it's another victory, isn't it? Because this is, I think it was just about 10 months ago or so, EDF agreed to pay a £4.5 million fine for doing misleading sales to ordinary customers. So it's another reason to swap away from EDF.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are lots of reasons for swapping away from the big six energy companies.
So why is that? I mean, are there any of them better than the others?
It's one of the things that we are pains to try and do is, if you like, to sort of split the pack and encourage some of these bigger energy companies to put more of their investment into renewable sources, pull out of nuclear, pull out of gas. And of those, the leader is probably SSE, Scottish and Southern Electric. They are the biggest investor in renewable energy in the UK. And there is clear water between them, if you want to look around. But we're proposing that you're promoting that people should get their electricity supplied through one of the greener suppliers, so that you've got good energy and electricity.
You have to pay more for it, Mike. That's the trouble. You've got to pay more for the green energy.
Well, that depends on which.
At the moment, we cannot barely pay the bills as it is.
It depends on which tariff you compare with which. If you compared the cheapest tariff that you could get from EDF with that from Good Energy or Ecotricity, you might find that EDF came out better. But in fact, if you compare the tariff that most people pay for EDF, there isn't that price
disadvantage. I mean, the obvious thing to do is to have some sort of little app, or whatever. Is there any way that Friends of the Earth is able to advise people, like on the website or whatever, as how to switch to a more ethical energy?
Yeah, you can certainly look on our website, and we will be relaunching that campaign to get people to switch to a more environmentally sound supplier. The other thing that's happening actually right at the moment is that the Centre for Sustainable Energy, which is a charity based here in Bristol, and the Bristol Pound and Bristol Credit Union are linking together to make an offer to the people of Bristol that we bulk buy from one of these more ethical energy suppliers. So you can go now to one of those organisations, Centre for Sustainable Energy, Bristol Credit Union or Bristol Pound, look for the Bristol Energy offer, and you can register your interest. And I think that runs until for about another month or so. They will then assess the number of people that are interested in switching, and they will negotiate a bulk deal with Good Energy or another supplier. So it will be using collective bargaining power, if you like, on behalf of a number of Bristol citizens who want to get a more ethical and better value energy deal. So it's a practical action that people can take now. If you're a Bristol resident, get out of EDF or one of the other big six and get into a more ethical scheme, and you'll even be able to pay your bill in Bristol pounds.
Wow. Over 2,200 people have already signed up to this. It's called Bristol Switch and Save. The website, www.bristolswitchandsave.org.uk. And one of the things I have to ask, Mike, is there any way for people to do this if they're not online? Because, I mean, particularly a lot of elderly people aren't necessarily internet savvy.
Yeah, I guess the best best advice would be to go to in person to Bristol Credit Union. I can't think of
any. There is a phone number. I've just discovered
brilliant,
an old-fashioned phone number, which maybe we should give again at the end of the programme, which is 0117 934 1400. That's 0117 934 1400. That's the Centre for Sustainable Energy. And I guess they will be able to tell you if you can do any of this without actually being you know, incredibly internet savvy or having some kind of smartphone app or whatever it is that you do these days. Anyway, Mike, the broader picture, nuclear, gas or green? Because this is what everyone's wondering, you know. Gas, not very sustainable. Coal, obviously, is, at least according to many people, slowly moving out of the picture because it's so polluting. And
we're closing down big coal-fired power stations in the UK right now.
There was a warning last month, actually, at the end of last month, saying that actually within a few years we could be just going through power cuts because there isn't enough power being generated.
Well,
and that's your fault. You environmentalists. You environmentalists have done it.
The National Grid are pretty confident that isn't going to happen. It's not been widely reported, but it's a piece of
Their fingers crossed.
It's a piece of scaremongering.
Well, I mean, it's happened in the US, you know, when after the privatisation. Well, I mean, I don't know how if they ever had a
Enronization.
The what?
The Enronization.
Enronization of the US system. Martin's chipping in there. I mean, the thing is, with the market, you know, the idea is that these power generation companies will produce the minimum they actually have to, and they won't necessarily have that reserve capacity for, say, you know, when there's a lot big demand on the system. So it is quite possible that, that there won't be actually enough power stations around, especially as the nuclear that we've already got goes off stream, the coal's going off stream, the gas is becoming too expensive. It may not be possible to have as many gas-fired power stations, and all the lobbying from new environmental types. I mean, it's going to mean that maybe we'll be switching the lights on and it will be dark. It'll be back to candles like it was if you remember back in the 1970s when they had the power strikes.
I do remember that, but you know, say National Grid are pretty confident they've got enough capacity projected to be online in over the next few years that they're going to be able to manage the system effectively. The ability of the grid to manage shortfalls in one area is really underrated, and people talk a lot about how problem it is with renewable energy that it only is on stream part of the time when the wind is blowing or the sun is shining or whatever. But the grid is perfectly capable of accepting that kind of input onto the system and keeping the lights on.
Okay, what about the energy bill?
Yeah, it's a really crucial piece of legislation. It sets the field, if you like, for the next 25, 30 years, the next generation of what kind of power we get investment in. At the moment, the government is holding back from a really essential step that they need to take, which is to specify to the power generators how much carbon dioxide, how much, you know, global warming they cause for each kilowatt of power that they generate. So they really need to be putting a figure in the bill that says, you know, by 2030 our carbon emissions per kilowatt hour of electricity we generate has to be down to a certain figure. If they do that, then they will create the certainty that investors need to put their money into renewable energy and instead of going for a dash for gas or chasing off after the nuclear dream. So it's a really important step that government can take now, but they are holding back from doing. But we've got an amendment has been tabled by one Conservative MP and one Labour, and we've now got a number of Liberal Democrats signed up to it as well. So we could be in a situation where we've got enough MPs to vote against the government that this target is inserted into the bill. So it's really important at this time to make your views known to your MP that you want this. We're calling it the Green Jobs Amendment because basically what it will do is stimulate a lot of investment in green jobs.
Well, what about windmills? Because I was reading recently that one of them was sabotaged. People going out into the fields and sort of undoing the bolts that are tying the windmills to this. I think in Wales somewhere. I mean, this, the thing with the wind generation is, number one, it doesn't really deliver a lot of power. Secondly, a lot of people who live close to these things hate them.
Well, both of those things are popular myths that are very eagerly promoted by people who are opposed to wind turbines, but neither of them is actually true. Okay. There was a proposal in on the Lizard Peninsula in Cornwall, Goonhilly Down, to repower a wind farm that was there. 14 existing turbines were taken away and replaced with 6 much larger ones. 98% of the people on the Lizard Peninsula that voted, expressed their views, supported that. So, you know, wind turbines can be pretty popular with people who live near them. In fact, usually the acceptance of wind turbines goes up after a wind farm appears in an area. People are less worried about it once
you've got to
live.
So long as you don't live too close, otherwise that whooping sound will drive you nuts at night time, isn't it?
Again, you know, there is a myth, and that this is a common problem. I was looking at the statistics recently that in 15 years of operation of all the wind farms in the UK, there have been something like 80 individuals have complained about the noise from wind farms. So it's a pretty trivial problem. It's not say it's
okay. You know, well, I mean, I can imagine it would be a bit nasty if it's too close to your house. Anyway, Mike Birkin from Southwest Frontier, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Final item. Why did the US embrace Nazi war criminals at the end of World War II? Was it just to fight the Russians in the Cold War, or was it more secret? Another secret deal done for Nazi uranium and plutonium? Let's have a listen now to an extract from a BBC Horizon programme, almost totally forgotten about, from 1992, called Hitler's Bomb.
In July 1940, von Weizsäcker made a further crucial discovery. As he explained to his military superiors, the uranium machine could be used to manufacture an entirely new nuclear explosive.
I realized that to make a bomb would be possible with what we now call plutonium directly, and that plutonium, or icarenium as I then said, would be produced in reactors by the fact that the reactor works, and therefore that this was an important and interesting question. I wrote a paper about that, and I also, it was a secret paper, of course, and it was given to the Army Ordnance.
Like Hitler's Blitzkrieg, the German uranium project had made rapid progress. Heisenberg and his colleagues had displayed their brilliance. They had already mapped out to the Wehrmacht the route to the atomic bomb.
Martin, that's from Horizon back in BBC programme back in 1992. It looks pretty, everybody knows that the deal done between the Nazis and the Americans at the end of World War II in order to help them fight the Russians, but this is a whole other side to it. It looks as if the Nazi bomb programme was very far advanced, and that possibly this plutonium and enriched uranium that they put together couldn't be used to bomb the Allies, but it was there was some sort of deal done in order that it could be used against the Germans' allies. Japan.
Yes, I mean the book concerned. Have you got what's it?
Yes, Carter Heydrich's book is called Critical Mass, and it's available online. I'll put a link up to it on the program's page, and that is program's page is thisweek.org.uk. We can't, I'm afraid, have any more time to discuss it because we've got to go to the news now. Yes, it's Tony Gosling wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. And don't let the banksters get you down. If you want to know more on that last story, just go to the webpage thisweek.org.uk.
Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky.